Outkick the coverage with Clay Travis live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
Now let's get this party started.
You're listening to Fox Sports Radio.
Welcome in, coming to you live from the Geico Outkick Studios. Wednesday edition, Outkick the Coverage, Fox Sports Radio, anywhere in the country, foxsportsradio.com. Or you can download the podcast, consume this program however you want, whenever you want. We make it available. Just search Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis. You will miss nothing. My voice is not Clay's, but he is with me. He is in Las Vegas, tape and television. I'm Jason Martin, used to be his executive producer, now the host of the Jason Martin Show here on Fox Sports Radio. On Twitter, at JMartZone. Clay's at Clay Travis. All right, Clay, I'm hearing a whole lot. You've been traveling. You were in L.A. Now you're in Vegas. I've heard quite a bit about the setup that you guys have for the NCAA tournament for locking in. I'm really excited to see what this looks like on TV. But from your perspective walking up to it, how impressive was this thing?
Well, it's late night in Vegas. So, you know, late night in Vegas, things oftentimes look different than they do in the daylight. That's one of the big stories of Vegas, right? So I'm doing the show right now. Late at night from my Vegas hotel room. I did Speak for Yourself. I did and Lock It In from L.A., hopped on a flight, got here tonight, and immediately went down to the set. And it's spectacular. I mean, it is real and spectacular to steal a line from Seinfeld. It's really, really cool. I mean, they have, if you are going to be in Las Vegas for the NCAA tournament, wherever you are across the country right now, whether it's late at night or early in the morning, whether you're on the West Coast or the East Coast listening to us right now on Outkick, this set is phenomenal. It is right at the entry point to the MGM Grand Sportsbook. So if you're going to go make a bet on any game in the MGM Grand Sportsbook, you cannot miss us. Like, you have to walk past us. We have got a big stage built up. They're going to be we'll be live on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday later today, Pacific time, at 1:30. The show airs at 4:30 Eastern, 3:30 Central, 2:30 Mountain. But it is going to be awesome. Wednesday, today, I'm not sure exactly what the vibe will feel like because the games won't be going on while we're on the air. But if you're like a lot of people and you watch the NCAA tournament games with like multiple different screens, we will basically have a live show emanating from a sports book. So if you're a fan out there and you've ever wondered what's it look like in a sports book while the NCAA tournament is going on, when our show is on, you'll be able to have that experience. And certainly if you are in the Las Vegas area on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, you can just come by and stand in the background and wave at your friends and be there to see our show and see us. So I think it is just going to be an utterly fantastic, really, really cool setup, and I can't wait to do it. This is something that hasn't been done really for a daily show that I'm aware of before, where you do a live show while there are games going on. And I think the big question is, and I was in the sports book tonight as the Fairleigh Dickinson game was going on, and also as the Belmont game came to a close against Temple. Belmont Bruins, big win for Rick Byrd, who's been in the NCAA tournament I think prior 7 times, yep. Never got a win. I think the big question now is, do you feel like the NCAA tournament really starts with the play-in games, or is that just like an appetizer that you're not that interested in? You want the buffet to start on Thursday at noon Eastern when all the games really start to tip. I'm kind of torn a little bit. I think if your team is in the play-in game, it certainly feels like the NCAA tournament is starting. But I think for most people, until you can pull out that highlighter and look at your bracket and start to mark, you know, yes or no based on how the bracket goes, it's hard to really count the play-in game as a legitimate start to the tourney.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I had Western Kentucky, my alma mater, was in it a handful of years ago, and so I cared then, obviously. And Belmont, you know, we both love Nashville. We both live in Nashville. We both talked to Rick Byrd many times. He's as classy as they come. You wanted to see potentially him get a win in the NCAA tournament. I have him beating Maryland as well. And I kind of think that's the win. This one, I want this to count because, and I guess technically it does, but these games, look, Fairleigh Dickinson and Prairie View A&M, all respect to them. I can't get excited about 2-16s playing. It doesn't mean that I can't tune in and watch it if it's close down the stretch, but I'm not sitting down and ordering a pie and grabbing brews or whatever. I'm not like inviting people over to the house to watch 2-16 seats play for the right to get crushed by Gonzaga later on this week. I just, 64 is kind of my limit. I understand what they're doing, and I know that people watch these games, and Dayton does a really good job hosting this event every year. The first four to me, appetizer, I'm not even sure I would call it an appetizer. I think you're still sitting there holding that little disc, and it hasn't, the laser hasn't hit yet. You don't have those red buttons going off to tell you your table is ready. I don't think we're even sitting at the table yet.
I feel like appetizer is probably an applicable moment, but I will tell you this, like the NIT's going and the NBA's going, and when I was in the sports book, the Belmont game in the evening, the last game to be played, Belmont against Temple, wasn't even on the primary screen. So I do feel like that cuts in favor of your, it's not even an appetizer part to the meal, because I was thinking to myself, oh, surely they're going to have the play-in games here and they're going to be getting a lot of attention, but they're on True TV. I'm actually a little bit curious to see what the overall ratings look like, because I know the national holiday of hoops starts tomorrow at noon Eastern, like I said, when the game actually tips off. But right now, I kind of feel like you, where, you know, it's hard to feel strong. Now, I will say this. On Lock It In, I'm the King. You know, I've had back-to-back weeks.
Sure.
I had a 5-0 night last night. So we have what is going to be pretty cool, and I don't even know what the punishments are. There is a spinning wheel of doom that we're going to be doing live on the air. And whoever has had the worst night of gambling will have to spin the wheel and suffer whatever outlandish punishment is on there live on television. So we've never done this before. We've never even been on the same set together, right? Like all four of us at the same time have, you know, we have, if you watch the show, we have like the little boxes that we all talk in. So this will be the first time we've ever sat on the show together on the same stage. And I think there are going to be some cool wrinkles, but everybody was anticipating, based on my gambling luck of late, that I was going to be the one who had to spin the wheel of doom. But I've been on such a roll, and I went 5-0 last night with the picks that I don't even have to do it. I don't even know if I've had a 5-0 night before on the show.
Well, Rachel's going to be on later. She's going to be on in the
That's
third
right.
hour, so we can go ahead and say that. So there's going to be a lot more Locking In talk coming.
She is going to. She said, you know, this could be a little bit like what always happens with Britt McHenry. She said that she is willing to get up on the show to promote. So it'll be a little bit different. You know how Britt McHenry, you when you were the manager, the executive producer of the show, you never really knew if Britt was going to be on or not.
Mm-hmm.
And she would say, like, oh, yeah, I'll definitely be up. But, you know, right now, Bonetta, when I talked to her before we left last night, the set, I was like, okay, you know, we're talking about, you know, 5:20 a.m.-ish. You understand that, right? She was like, oh, yeah, I'll be good to go. So whether or not that actually ends up happening, I think is you probably set some odds on that yourself.
I know usually you do this. You do this every year when you go out to Vegas for the tournament, and we have this same discussion. But I think that it's worth intimating again what an experience it is to watch the first round. I would call it the first real round of the NCAA tournament, Thursday and Friday, in a casino with a bunch of complete degenerates on all those big screens. Obviously, you've got your TV set and all of those things, but just take us through for a couple of minutes just the chaos and the craziness and kind of the sports nirvana that takes place in Vegas during the NCAA tournament.
Well, uniquely, and I don't know if you agree with me on this, but I think the NCAA tournament is a rare sporting event that peaks as it begins. And what I mean by that is, the first round of the NFL playoffs, the wild card round of the NFL playoffs, is, I think, for most people, nowhere near as good as the Super Bowl, right? Or certainly the divisional round or the AFC and NFC championship games. I think for most people, the NBA playoffs, opening round of the NBA playoffs, is not what you live for, right? Even though there are 16 teams all starting. Same thing with the NHL. There's this bevy, cornucopia of different games that you can watch. I feel like the NCAA tournament gets worse every round. And I've felt this way ever since I was a kid. Like, The Thursday and Friday is like Christmas Eve and Christmas morning. And everything else is a little bit less significant. It's like you'll enjoy the entire Christmas holiday when you're a kid, right? But if you are somebody who celebrates Christmas, which the vast majority, I would imagine, of people who listen to us are, then that Christmas Eve and Christmas is the culmination of you being out of school for 2 weeks. And everything else is fun, and you enjoy it. And New Year's is like the final four weekend, and that's fun. But if you're a kid, Christmas Eve and Christmas is like the NCAA tournament. And I don't know in the world of sports that there's anything else where the beginning, when all the anticipation and all the excitement and all the expectations and that fresh bracket that you filled out that you're convinced, oh, I'm going to nail it this year. I'm going to put together the greatest bracket that's ever been created. I'm going to win that billion-dollar prize or whatever it is. All of those things commingle and come together, and at that moment of Thursday and Friday, it's the best it'll ever be. And it reminds me, every year at the start of the NCAA tournament, it reminds me and takes me back to when I was a kid, and you would be sometimes in elementary school or 7th or 8th grade or whatever, maybe sometimes high school. And if you were at school, there was usually a cool teacher who would roll in the television.
Yep.
And on those days, everybody who's listening knows that feeling, right? You would be like, oh, my God, I can't believe we get to watch basketball at school. And it just felt like a national holiday. And I hope there are still some of those teachers who are willing to do that now for their kids who are sitting. And this is certainly true all over the country when there's games going on, even more so if you're on the West Coast where the games start at 9:15 in the morning or whatever. But that experience is just something that I remember so well from elementary school, and it's something that that never gets old. And that feeling of Christmas morning, of Christmas Eve, is basically palpable in the sports book. Even though it's all adults, even though it's all grown-ups, you have that nervous, anticipatory excitement that takes you back to childhood. And that, to me, is what makes the NCAA tournament experience in Vegas so unique and at the top of so many people's bucket list.
Yeah, I was trying to think, as you were saying, is there another sport that peaks this way? The NCAA tournament, I completely agree with you, because what you really want, you don't want your bracket to be right. You really want to toss that thing out Thursday night because it's been so chaotic. Because at that point, you're pulling for the Davids against the Goliaths. As you get further in the tournament, you realize, uh-oh, now we don't have these heavyweights to watch. The basketball's supposed to get better, but it's the kind of unpredictable nature of the first couple of rounds that drive it. I guess maybe you could talk about the Masters being the first major. Obviously, with the PGA Tour,
or the Daytona 500.
Yes. Like those things, maybe, but maybe not quite the exact same way.
Yeah, and I feel like there's an argument for those, but I feel like it's such a crescendo. And you're right. Like, once the Sweet 16 happens, you start to sit back and you're like, you know what? I don't really want,
I don't need Loyola Chicago to get to the Final Four. I don't need George Mason to get to the Final Four.
I don't want, maybe, but you don't want those teams to play for the championship.
For
sure. People out there who say, yes, I do. Like, nobody wanted to watch when Butler, was it Butler and UConn?
Oh, that game was so bad. It was horrible.
It was an awful game, right? Butler-UConn is probably the worst matchup in the last 15 or 20 years. People say they want the underdogs to win, and I think that's true on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the opening weekend. But once you get to the Sweet 16, television ratings reflect that people would love, like, the best possible matchup, I really believe, from a television perspective, would be a fourth Duke-UNC game.
No doubt.
Right? I really do. I think that Duke-UNC, in terms of producing the biggest possible crowd, would be, for television executives, the best. With a little asterisk beside it, I also think Duke-Kentucky would do insanely well, too. Big brands that everybody knows, with coaches that everybody's aware of. People say they want the underdog to win, but deep down, when it comes to ratings, people want Goliath to kick David's ass once it gets to the Sweet 16.
Yep, I absolutely agree. We're going to switch gears. We're going to talk more tournament basketball a little bit later on this hour. We're going to talk some NFL with our good friend Alex Marvez.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Welcome back, Geico Outkick Studios. We got Alex Marvez in here with us now. He usually joins us on Mondays, but he's joining us on Wednesday this week. Appreciate you doing that, Alex Marvez. I want to start with this question for you. I know we're on the eve of the NCAA tournament, but the NFL keeps making news. Blake Bortles headed to the Rams. Your reaction when you heard that story?
The boat. I love it. Not the goat, because he wasn't all that good in Jacksonville, but the boat is headed to Southern California. And listen, if you are Blake Bortles, and this is, you know, probably his last gasp to get his NFL career in order, I think this is fantastic. Now, I don't know how good it is for the Rams. Don't get me wrong here. But there were times in 2017 that Blake Bortles, you know, flashed a little bit. Yes, dare I say flashed. I'll be honest with you. I thought that he had really come along and was someone who in 2018 was going to be able to build on that. And then for a variety of reasons, after a 3-1 start, everything fell apart. His receivers got injured. His offensive line ended up on IR. You know, Leonard Fournette, you know, if he wasn't injured, he was acting the fool, right? I mean, you name it. And then came the turnovers and the turnovers and the turnovers. And next thing you know, I mean, you're talking Cody Kessler is in your starting lineup for Jacksonville, and Blake Bortles is on his way out of town. So can they fix these types of problems with Blake Bortles? Is it something where Sean McVay has a system that's very quarterback-friendly? I mean, Clay, you see how Jared Goff has been able to excel, and Jared got a little bit exposed, quite honestly, against the New England Patriots in Super Bowl 53. Sean McVay falls on the sword for some of that as well because of his bad game planning. But that being said, if Blake Bortles is ever going to become a solid quarterback in this league again, he really couldn't be going to a better place with much better talent than what he had before and some guys who will know how to coach him better than what he was getting in Jacksonville.
Is it possible? Like, so Ryan Tannehill is also going to go play for the Titans now. Obviously, a few years ago, if I'd had you on, I've been saying, hey, Nick Foles, this guy had 27 touchdowns 1 year, 2 interceptions the next, but man, he's fallen off the reservation to the point where he was almost not even going to be continuing to play football, right? Is it possible that in your mind that either Blake Bortles or Ryan Tannehill or anybody else out there could have a Nick Foles-like resurgence, or do you think everybody who's currently kind of on the, it seems like the back nine of their career, even the back three or four holes, is basically done? Is there basically, what I'm asking you is there any reclamation project out there that could be the next Nick Foles?
Well, I mean, listen, on the positive side with Tannehill, and I think that there is a possibility that he could work his way back into the starting lineup somewhere in 2020. I mean, look, Marcus Mariota hasn't, I don't think he's been able to put together a full 16-game season without getting, you know, injured, having to miss time at some point. You know, also, too, you know, I'm curious how Arthur Smith, yes, Arthur Smith, the new Tennessee Titans offensive coordinator, you know, handles this role. Mike Vrabel, you know, he hires Matt LaFleur. Matt's there for a year. I think it was really inconsistent, the job that Matt LaFleur did, but he blew away Packers management with his job interview. So he goes to Green Bay as head coach, and instead they promote the tight ends coach to work with Marcus Mariota. I don't know how good this offense is going to be, but I'll tell you this. I like the supporting cast in a lot of ways. I think that Corey Davis is really, you know, ready to step up his game at wide receiver in 2019. The addition of Adam Humphries gives a top-notch slot target. You look at Delanie Walker coming back, and of course you have the King, Derrick Henry, teaming up with Deion Lewis once again in a pretty darn solid offensive line. So I actually like the situation that Tannehill is stepping into. You know, the other guy, but again, he's got to get on the field, which means either, you know, you're looking at a situation where Marcus Mariota isn't playing well or he's hurt once again. You know, weird one too with you know, Teddy Bridgewater. Think about the state of the Miami Dolphins right now, Clay. You and you know, for that matter, Tyrod Taylor as well, out with the L.A. Chargers. You would rather go sit as a backup than you would play. I mean, and essentially that's what we're talking about here, because, you know, with Teddy Bridgewater, he was courted by the Dolphins, and Tyrod Taylor was too. And yeah, the Dolphins may draft a quarterback and will probably fast-track that player, if they do indeed draft him, to be in the starting lineup. But, Clay, we're talking about, you know, starting opportunities in this league so that you don't get labeled as a career backup. And Teddy Bridgewater passing on that, thinking that maybe the grass is going to be greener ultimately with the New Orleans Saints, no guarantees of that. You know, and Tyrod Taylor sitting behind Phillip Rivers. Again, I think at this point Tyrod is just going to be a backup for the rest of his career. So, you know, I just think when guys have a chance to start, and I know it's Fitzmagic now in South Florida, and you just shake your head, you know, why Colin Kaepernick can't get a job in this league, and guys like Ryan Fitzpatrick on his 8th NFL team, and 50 and 71, I believe, as a starter, is getting another go-around on for the Miami Dolphins. That's another story for another day. But that being said, it also it reflects, number one, the state of the Dolphins. Number two, just how few competent quarterback options there seem to be in the NFL beyond what you have as a starting 32.
It is fascinating to see how desperate everybody is to find that right fit at the quarterback position. Do you believe now, as we get roughly a little bit over a month away till the NFL draft, that it's basically a foregone conclusion based on who you talk to, that the Cardinals are going to bring in Kyler Murray at the first number one overall pick?
I still think it's undecided. I think that this process is ongoing because at some point, too, they're going to have to reach out before the draft and make sure they got a landing spot for Josh Rosen, right? And because let's say you're the New York Giants, and while Josh Rosen isn't available until the night of the draft, you may already be so committed to drafting another quarterback with one of those two first-round picks that you just say, you know what, I'm not ready for this move with Josh Rosen. We feel a little bit better about going with the prospect that we have spent the past 2 or 3 months closely scouting. And now I'm just using the Giants as an example of a team that, you know, would need a de facto starter potentially if the Cardinals are shopping Josh Rosen. You know, I mean, it's such a weird thing that the Cardinals are doing here because, Clay, they're adding a lot of older players. So, like, you know, Terrell Suggs, so what are you as a team? Are you coming or are you going? Are you going to be rebuilding around another rookie quarterback? Is this what's happening here and you're adding all these veteran pieces to your team? You know, because, you know, I just don't think you can win, with a rookie quarterback in the NFL. I mean, unless you have an incredible supporting cast, and the Cardinals do not have that. So what is it that they're doing here? You know, so just I don't know where they're at. But see, they're the team in a lot of ways that control the draft because if they pass on Kyler Murray, and let's say you're the Miami Dolphins and you're committed to Kyler Murray, and they did have a private workout with him, by the way, after his Oklahoma Pro Day last week, but you think Kyler Murray is all that in a bag of donuts and the next Dan Marino, et cetera. Well, I think you're hoping that Arizona passes up, and San Francisco's hoping that Arizona passes up, because the 49ers, by acquiring Dee Ford in a trade, suddenly their need for an edge rusher has been alleviated a little bit, and it's a team that has some other holes, especially in the secondary, that they may want to fill. And they need a number one wide receiver. So if you're talking about the Dolphins here, what would the Dolphins be willing to give up to move up from number 13, for example? Would it be Kenny Stills, you know, along with their first-round draft pick? And then the 49ers drop down to 13, acquire some more picks, and they're off and running from there. I mean, the other thing with Murray, which I find so fascinating, it's like, I don't know if this is going to happen, but could there be an Aaron Rodgers-type drop for Kyler Murray? When we look at teams that are drafting in the in the top 10, for example, that have, you know, which on paper we perceive as a quarterback need. Now, let's say Jacksonville. You know, they signed Nick Foles to a 4-year deal, but is it really a 1-year deal or a 2-year deal? Would they be looking in round one? I just don't know if Tom Coughlin is going to be taking a smaller quarterback like Kyler Murray. John Elway's already been on record saying that he thinks that a smaller quarterback would struggle taking snaps from under center, so you could scratch him off. You know, the New York Giants, I don't think they've had a smaller quarterback since Fran Tarkenton. So I don't really know if that's a team for them as well. So the Dolphins, sitting there at 13, they could end up, if they like Kyler Murray, they may be in a great spot to not have to give up the entire farm to get him. So this is just sort of fascinating right now, what's going on with the quarterbacks. Do teams fall in love with Dwayne Haskins? Does someone fall in love with Drew Locke? You know, Daniel Jones is following in Eli Manning's footsteps as far as a David Cutcliffe protege, over at Duke, and someone that would make it a little bit easier, I think, for Eli to pass the baton when that time comes in the 2019 season. So I'm fascinated by this because I really don't think there is a locked-in number one pick at this point.
What do you think in general about the story in Pittsburgh? You had, obviously, Le'Veon's finally gone. You finally get Antonio Brown out. You think maybe we're going to have a little bit of a calm now. And then Ben Roethlisberger accused of intentionally fumbling the football. What are you hearing out of Steelers camp about all the drama there?
Well, I mean, listen, Ben has clashed with coaches before. Okay, so that's no surprise right there. I mean, I think if you look at the video, I mean, Ben Roethlisberger's got to be an absolute magician to fumble that play. Because, you know, and Bruce Gradkowski explained this after, and Bruce was Ben's backup at the time. It was an unusual formation with a fullback that he just wasn't prepared to hand off that quickly because the fullback looked like he was shot out of a cannon, and by the time Ben turned around, there was a bad handoff. But you're right, it's a team right now that, you know, in another way, too, they're not real good at damage control in that regard. Like, you know, there's so much outside noise that surrounds this team. And even Jesse James, you know, the Steelers tight end who left to the Detroit Lions, he said, I'm happy to get away from the drama. So it's something that has to stop. I think when OTAs begin, the off-season program, starting on April 8th, I mean, it's probably going to be a back-to-basics by Mike Tomlin in that regard, and he's got to lean on veteran players, you know, to help try to mitigate this sort of stuff, right? And Ben Roethlisberger has to show a little bit more maturity when he speaks with the media. Don't throw your teammates under the bus. You know, that's what he did at the midway point of the season, you know, with their wide receiver James Washington as a rookie. I mean, really, you know, trash the kid. And I understand his frustration that James isn't a perfect receiver, but he's also a rookie. And I think, you know, Ben just has to watch himself a little bit on that. But these guys, you know, a house divided cannot stand, so to speak. And I really think that last year, some of that had a big-time role with the way the Steelers performed. Clay, too, look, is Mark Barron going to be the solution for the absence of Ryan Shazier? Because that was something that really crushed the Steelers last year as well. How do they compensate for the loss of Mike Munchak on the offensive line? No guarantees that the assistant who was there, you know, waiting in the wings is going to be doing as good a job as he is. Is that Steelers secondary going to come together? I mean, and who's going to step up to replace all those 100-plus catches that Antonio Brown amassed, you know, year after year since he's been with the Steelers? I mean, look, I mean, this team right now in Cleveland for the first time, I think, since the 80s, is in a top 10 preseason Super Bowl favorite. Last I checked it at a FanDuel website, it was 17-1 odds on the Browns winning the Super Bowl. So, I mean, and let alone the division, which I think, you know, a lot of folks are penciling in on that. We'll see what happens with Freddie Kitchens, if he's truly ready to be a head coach in this league and handle all of these lofty expectations and get his guys focused on the task at hand. But the Steelers, I think, have lost some juice in the AFC North, and a lot of it their own fault.
We're talking to Alex Marvez. You can follow him on Twitter at Alex Marvez. He joins us usually on Mondays, with us Wednesday now, as we roll through the biggest stories in the world of the NFL. This Robert Kraft story, and reports yesterday that he may be able to get out without having to officially say I'm guilty, but he'd have to admit maybe I would have been guilty. What do you think ends up happening in that situation with the NFL, and then also the off-the-court situation surrounding Tyreek Hill? What are you hearing about both of those in terms of how the league might respond?
Well, you know, Robert Kraft he is expected to be in Arizona next week, Clay, and we'll be talking from Phoenix bright and early on Monday morning. You know, he is expected to be in Arizona at the NFL owners' meetings. I'm going to be curious if he issues a statement. Of course, media is going to want to talk to him. He may just keep a low profile, but I'm sure he's going to have some talks with other owners in person who want to know, what are you thinking? You know, and I would imagine because of the embarrassment this has brought to the NFL that it's, again, a six-game, $500,000 fine, you know, and six-game suspension from being around the team. And, you know, he may end up recusing himself, so to speak, potentially, although I think as time, this is what I've heard, but as time goes on, I think it's less and less likely, but a situation, since Jonathan Kraft does so much of the heavy lifting for the Patriots anyway, that I'm going to go seek counseling, and we'll have my son Jonathan will be taking over the reins of the team to give a little bit of a PR spin to what's going on with Robert Kraft. You know, for Tyreek Hill, we're waiting, you know, and listen, I just hope it isn't true. I hope a three-year-old didn't break his arm at the hands of Tyreek Hill. I mean, this is catastrophic for him if this were the case, because all of that big money that he was going to be making from the Kansas City Chiefs, it disappears. And, you know, but I will say this, so far, and you know what, Clay, NFL teams have their police sources all over the place, right? And in this case, it's been pretty radio silent. And the Chiefs haven't made a move to try to add another receiver. They've just kept a low profile as far as Tyreek Hill. So maybe, just maybe, you had this initial report. Maybe it involves his fiance more than it does Tyreek Hill. I mean, I think if you're the Chiefs, you got your fingers crossed that that's the case. But, no, and listen, I mean, obviously severe punishment when it comes to the NFL. But I will say this. Look, we had Adrian Peterson and his situation of beating his son with a switch as discipline, and the photos that emerged, and he came back into the NFL. I just feel like, you know, until there's some, I mean, Greg Hardy, if he could play again well, he would have been in the NFL still. It didn't matter to people. Ray Rice is really the only guy who paid the ultimate price for this because of the videotape that was involved. No videotape on Tyreek Hill. I would imagine someone at some point would give him another chance once again, you know, once he goes through all of the, you know, counseling, et cetera, when it comes to that situation, if he is indeed, you know, charged with child abuse.
Yeah, the other thing on Ray Rice is it wasn't just Ray Rice being on video. It was that Ray Rice was on video, and most people decided he was past his prime as a player, right, as a running back. So if he had been 23, like Kareem Hunt is, I think there's a good chance that somebody would have taken a chance on Ray Rice even after that video. Do you agree in general with that?
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly on that. The feeling was that he was a declining player. You know, too, with Kareem Hunt, and it's just really odd. Why 8 games, Clay? And I've just sort of given up on trying to figure out what the NFL's doing. They issue a statement. They don't say, like has been speculated by the folks I've talked with in Cleveland about this, that, oh, well, you know, it's because he also had other instances off the field where he almost got into bar fights and was embarrassing the league with his behavior at a club. You know, and you've seen some of that video appear since the initial video surfaced of him, you know, kicking that girl over and really tipping her over with his foot. It wasn't like a UFC-type kick to the face. I'm not condoning it. I'm just trying to be real, though, about what you saw on that videotape. You know, 8 games? Really? I mean, just when so many others get 6, I just don't understand what the NFL's modus operandi is. You know, if there's like some sort of giant spinning wheel that takes place and they spin it and it lands on a number and they say, okay, this is it. You know, Roger Goodell's wheel of punishment. And maybe you could even, you know, get Bob Barker to come out of retirement and narrate the thing. I mean, it just drives me crazy because when people ask me, well, why 8 games? I don't have a legitimate answer for you. Why 8? Why not 6? Since everyone else that seems to be involved in this sort of situation, you know, like a Ray Rice, you know, like a Greg Hardy, you know, those are guys that served 6-game suspensions. Ezekiel Elliott, too.
Not only that, I mean, he was put on the commissioner's non-exempt list, and he wasn't able to finish the year, so arguably he already served part of his suspension. It would be my argument if I were a lawyer representing him.
And instead, he's just taking it. You know, he's like, let me move on here. And, you know, apparently he has been in the building every day in Cleveland, and he's trying to get his life right. Look, and I'm not making excuses for the guy, but just, you know, had a dad who's been in and out of jail multiple times, had his own problems, you know, freshman year, you know, at the University of Toledo. I mean, it's just someone who, you know, just simply couldn't handle alcohol very well either, obviously, that fueled so much of this. So, you know, look, I'm hoping that there's a success story here, that he takes advantage of this next opportunity. And I'm selfish, Clay. I want to see the guy on the field. He's a hell of a running back. And, you know, in Cleveland, my gosh, him and Nick Chubb, I mean, you know, with Baker Mayfield, with Odell Beckham Jr., with Jarvis Landry, with Antonio Callaway, oh, my gosh. By the way, you notice that connecting thread, Kareem Hunt and Tyreek Hill? It's John Dorsey. He was the GM when both were drafted. Very interesting. We'll see if some of these decisions end up blowing up in John's face, you know, in Cleveland, like when he takes chances on guys, you know, like it has happened now that he's out of Kansas City, and you've had Kareem Hunt implode and Tyreek Hill potentially having done the same.
Outstanding stuff. As always, we're talking with Alex Marvez. Alex, my man, appreciate you joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
We'll do it on Monday from Phoenix. Thanks, Clay.
When we come back, we'll dive back into the NCAA tournament on the eve of the tournament officially beginning. I don't count these play-in games. This is Outkick the Coverage on Fox Sports Radio.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Welcome back to the Geico Outkick Studios. Our thanks to Alex Marvez, still to come, John Campbell, also Rachel Bonetta. Well, we think if she wakes up, we'll join the program in hour 3. We don't want Rachel to become Britt McHenry. I'm Jason Martin. Clay Travis, you hear him laughing in the background. He's at the MGM Grand out in Vegas for the remainder of the week, having way too much fun at the NCAA tournament. All right, Clay, we do our show out of Nashville. We have a lot of great people that work with us out in Los Angeles, but you and I both live in the Music City, and Belmont gets this win last night by 11 over Temple. They finally get an opportunity where they're not a 15 or a 14, and they cash in. They win a game impressively. Now they've got Maryland, who I actually have them beating as well. Rick Byrd was 0-7, the head coach at Belmont, before this tournament. This feels like one of those wins where the basketball gods are like, all right, this guy has so much respect. The peers absolutely love him. And this, to me, I would say, and I would like to know if you agree with this, tournament selection committee didn't get maligned for very much. Michigan State, that's kind of the one thing that people continually are pointing to right now. But I'm glad Belmont got a shot and not an Alabama or an NC State or a team like that that's going to go play mediocre Power 5 conference basketball, as opposed to a 26-win team that would have got an automatic bid had the number 3 pick in the NBA draft not also happened to be in the Ohio Valley Conference, which is not a thing that's probably ever going to happen again.
Yeah, look, I felt really good for Rick Byrd. Yeah, like I said, I'm out here in the casino. I was watching it. I bet on Belmont. I know that that some people in the national media did not think that the selection committee deserved credit here. I am a guy that believes, like, if you have to choose between a school with all the advantages that was mediocre, like in NC State, right? Like, let's just say it. I mean, that's the team that seems to be the most upset that they didn't get into the tournament. Or a school like Belmont, which had a phenomenal year, and then, like you said, happened to run into a buzzsaw in a virtual road game. Murray State's fans all showed up. I think there's a good chance Murray State is going to beat Marquette. They're a really good team. Like what you said, maybe the guy who goes number three overall in the draft, certainly a top five pick, depending on who wins the lottery in Morant. And so, to me, this is everything that the NCAA tournament's about. And when you come to the decision-making on would I rather reward a team that was coming into this game, Belmont was 14-1 in their last 15. Their statistics were off the chart. They had been playing phenomenal basketball. This is a really talented team. And they took it to Temple. They ran away from them late. They dominated Temple down the stretch. And I loved everything about this win. I feel good for Belmont. It means a lot more to Belmont to win this game than it would have somebody like NC State. And I think the committee got it right to put Belmont in. And certainly the performance that they put forward in winning by double digits against Temple is a major ratification to the NCAA selection committee. And look at all of the success that teams have had coming out of these play-in games. I think if you win a game, and certainly VCU is the best example of this, but in the past several years, if you win a game, I think going back to 2014 now, there's a really good chance that one of these 11 seeds is going to go out and upset one of the 6 seeds. So Maryland, I'd put the Terrapins on notice right now. There's something about getting that win that gets people a little bit more comfortable, gets them ready for that game in a couple of days, and takes away some of the sting, gets them a little bit of rhythm. I'd be on notice if I'm Maryland right now.
Yeah, and Belmont's a team that we just know is going to be well-coached because of Rick Burden. I think it's interesting that two teams in the state of Tennessee in this tournament have similar narratives with their coaches. Guys that have a ton of respect, that are known to be all-class, but when they get to the tournament, usually it just hasn't worked out for them. Now, Texas got to the Final Four one time, but that was it for Rick Barnes. So people are looking at Tennessee, the Vols this year, and thinking, well, they could make a run. And if they don't, then that narrative about Rick Barnes is still going to be there. I'm hoping that Rick Bird's able to get past Maryland. I did pick them not because of that, but just because I think that they're talented enough to do it. Because I think just winning the play-in game still leaves an asterisk that I don't necessarily think that you want. But you talk about the 2-11 seeds. There's also the 2-16 seeds that played, and Fairleigh Dickinson won by 6, and they've got the chance to go play Gonzaga. We finally saw number one go down last year. And that was the Virginia Cavaliers, obviously, against Maryland, Baltimore County. The hangover effect that Virginia's program is experiencing in terms of how people are picking them or maybe not picking them as it relates to the NCAA tournament. That's something I want to discuss with you as we open up Hour 2. We will also be joined by John Campbell. Also, Rachel Bonetta will join the program in Hour 3. Stick with us. Rolling right along on a Wednesday. Tournament starts tomorrow. Outkick the coverage, Fox Sports Radio. Welcome back. Coming to you live from the Geico Outkick Studios, hour number two, Outkick the Coverage radio program, Wednesday edition. This is what I said at the end of the hour. I really wanted to get into this in a little bit more detail. Virginia opens up the tournament against Gardner-Webb, a 1 versus 16 again in Columbia, South Carolina. And Virginia has only lost 3 times this year. They lost in the ACC tournament. I don't know how much that really mattered. And they lost to Duke twice in the regular season. That's not really something that you can kind of hate on, I guess you would say, Clay. But the thing is, it seems like people are still penalizing Virginia for past errors. And certainly last year being the first one to go down to a 16. I've actually seen a few brackets and a few people make predictions on television over the past 48 hours that Gardner-Webb is going to beat Virginia. I'm serious. It's ridiculous to me.
Yeah, that would be, look, I'm out in Vegas. People out there just starting off your mornings. We're doing an early morning, late night, however you want to classify it, show here. I want to reiterate again, people should come to the MGM Grand. I want to meet a lot of listeners and a lot of television viewers. We are doing Lock It In live from the MGM Grand at 1:30 in the afternoon Pacific on today, Wednesday, tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday during the NCAA tournament. So it's going to be awesome. Right in the middle of their sports book. You can't miss us. Now, I read an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal about this specifically. It said that last year, 29% of all brackets picked Virginia to win the national championship. This year, what percentage of brackets do you think are picking Virginia to win the national championship?
Under 10? I don't know. It's got to be low.
5%.
That's absurd.
Even though they are a one seed. So the article in the Wall Street Journal was saying, as everybody looks for tips on how to fill out their bracket, that we are, as a group, prone to believe that whatever has happened before is going to happen again. And if you are willing to step outside of the bounds of normal, you know, like human thought, and take a risk that the best team you can pick right now to win your bracket challenge based on the percentages that is a one seed is Virginia. Everybody wants to go with the conventional wisdom. A lot of people picking Duke. A lot of people picking UNC. A lot of people picking Kentucky because those are teams that have won it before or have won a lot in the tournament in the past. Michigan State's a popular pick too. But the value of everybody out there, even more than Gonzaga, for number one seeds is Virginia. And the reason why people aren't picking Virginia is because of what happened last year to Maryland, Baltimore County. They lost as a one seed to a 16 seed. And so as a result, you get that reputation. You mentioned it earlier. Jay Wright had this reputation.
Yeah, he did.
There was, we talked about this yesterday on Lock It In. There was the expectation that Jay Wright was always going to choke, that his team wasn't going to perform at the highest level once they got to the tournament. And bang, what have they done in the last 3 years? They've won two championships, and that first championship kind of came out of nowhere, right? It is really intriguing how people expect what has happened before to continue to happen forever. So if you are out there and you are filling out your bracket, remember that you need to, if you're going to win, usually you need to get the champion right. And if you're going to get the champion right and it ends up being somebody like Duke, well, then you're going to have to get so many different picks right in order to win your bracket challenge because so many people are going to pick Duke. But there is tremendous value in being willing or able to pick a team that not everybody else is picking. And that this year, certainly of the one seeds, that is Virginia. Now, it would be kind of hysterical on some level if they lost as a 16 to a 16 teams, a 16 seed again in Gardner Webb. I mean, I would feel awful for Virginia fans, but I think it would kind of be amazing and funny at the same time. But I tend to think that Virginia is going to come out, play really well, put away Gardner Webb early. I am betting, and I'll go ahead and tell you this, I am betting on Virginia to cover that big number and to roll in their first game.
I would actually go farther, not just with Virginia. I think it's possible that the average margin of victory for the number one seeds against the 16s, and look, Iona might be, Iona's a team that's been in the tournament before. They're a 16, they're playing against North Carolina. Iona could maybe ruin this prediction, but I could see these being average 25 to 30 point games. Seriously, like it's not even that this tournament is chalk. It's that these four seeds, especially with what happened last year, this ain't the Triple Crown. We're not going to get a couple of horses over a small span that's going to do this. It's happened once. We may not see it again in our lifetime. We could see it. You know, obviously there's going to be four chances at it, but Duke, Gonzaga, Virginia, North Carolina, nobody wants to be the second team to do this either. And Virginia's going to come out there with absolutely everything. And then you can make the argument, look, all right, well, when they're close, let's say Gardner Webb's close with them 10 minutes into the game. Are they going to start looking up at the scoreboard? Probably not. Honestly, because Virginia did, after that loss last year, exactly what Villanova did after their losses, which was own those defeats. Jay Wright owned the losses. Tony Bennett owned the losses. They did not make excuses. They didn't do anything but say, look, we were just not the better team. We've got to be better than that. We've got to show up to play. They beat us in all facets of the game. They owned it. They took ownership of it. They took responsibility for those losses. I don't think that there's necessarily a carryover effect when your attitude is, we've got to put that behind us. That was not our best day. We will be back. And I feel like Tony Bennett's the kind of coach that you should believe in, not just because they've struggled over the past few years. This guy's an incredible basketball coach. And year after year, eventually it's going to be his time. I mean, the other great story, you talk about how great it would be if they lost to another 16. Imagine if they lost to a 16 and then cut the Nets down a year later.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
I mean, that'd be incredible.
That's why I say, if you're filling out your brackets and you want to pick a one seed that nobody else is picking, 5% right now of the brackets are picking UVA versus 29.5% last year. And the crazy thing is, like, in, I think it's Jerry Palm's methodology, UVA, according to his numbers, is the strongest team to enter the NCAA tournament in 18 years. So according to his numbers, in terms of predictive value based on what he's seeing on the offensive and defensive sides of the ball, they are in the top four on both sides. And the argument is, and this was a great Wall Street Journal article, which is what I was reading today on my plane flight to Las Vegas, trying to do all my prep for the tournament, is that if Duke's name was on University of Virginia's team jerseys, right, if you just looked at the name and it was Duke, that they would be an even more prohibitive favorite than Duke is, yet you can get UVA right now at 6 or 7 to 1 to go out and win this tournament. And so, look, maybe there's a psychological element to this. Maybe in the first and second round in particular, there's a part of Virginia that is like a little bit psychologically unstable as a team because of what they went through against Maryland, Baltimore County. I'm betting them to win big on Friday. They're a 22.5-point favorite. I think they're going to go out and win by 30 or more, and they ain't going to take their foot off the gas either. If they start to get up, I think they are going to pour it on. You know, sometimes teams will lighten up a little bit. I think the 16 seed might as well be a top five opponent for them.
Yeah, and you look at the rest of their bracket, there's not a whole lot of teams that scare you there. Like, there are some brackets where I look at some of the teams in some of these other regions and say, yeah, okay, that one could be trouble, but I'm not worried about Wisconsin. I'm not worried about Kansas State. Villanova, I'm not worried about this year. Purdue is just not a team that I trust. Tennessee's the only one. And here in the state of Tennessee, everybody seems thrilled that they're in Virginia's bracket, because of the way that they play, because both teams play slow-down basketball. This is a slow-down region. There's not a whole lot of get-up-and-go in the South this year. I think Virginia and Tennessee, should we get lucky enough to get that matchup, could be a whale of a basketball game. I don't know if I can get Tennessee to the Final Four. I have not filled out my bracket as of yet. I've still got a little bit of time. Originally, I thought Tennessee could go very, very deep in this tournament, and I'm not changing that based on what I saw Sunday in the SEC final, because I just believe Tennessee left everything they had on the floor in the semi to beat Kentucky and just had nothing left on Sunday. Plus, Auburn made about 9,000 threes in that game. But Virginia-Tennessee, to me, is a really, really intriguing matchup if we get chalk and we get the top two seeds there in the South.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that that would be an incredible game, and I think they match up well. And I'm with you in that when you look at this bracket, there is not a team. Like, what did UVA have trouble with? They had trouble with length and athleticism
right
from Duke. And by the way, if you want the stat, like the one stat out there that should make you nervous if you're a Duke fan or if you're a Duke bracket filler in or who wants Duke to go out and win, they would be the worst three-point
yep
shooting team maybe ever to win a, you know, in the modern era where the three-point line exists. I don't want somebody to be like, well, there wasn't a three-point line in 1974. Okay. Since the three-point line has existed, Duke would be the worst outside shooting team to win the NCAA tournament, right? And so maybe Duke's going to get hot, but at some point in time, you usually need to make an outside shot. So what UVA has had trouble with is really athletic length teams like Duke. And there's not a lot of Dukes out there. And there's certainly none in their bracket between now and the Final Four, because Tennessee is good, but they're a lot like UVA, right? Like, very disciplined, really well-coached, crisp, but not necessarily the team that's going to wow you with their athleticism. And so I think we could get a whale of a game between Virginia and Tennessee if that were to happen in the finals of that region. I got another question for you. So we talk a lot about how to fill your brackets out and advice and everything else. We talked a lot in hour one about Belmont getting the win. Mm-hmm. Fairleigh Dickinson went out and won as a 16 seed. Does it strike you as unfair that a team that won its conference is a 16 seed? should have to do the play-in game. If I were made like czar of the NCAA tournament, and I think they get a lot of it right. You know, remember the idea back in the day that our kids will never understand is that you used to just get one of the four games, right? I mean,
yes.
Like if you're on television, you'd only get one, whichever one was regionally closest to you. And otherwise, you had to go out to the sports bar in order to watch all the games. Like, that's such a foreign idea now. But I will say, if the play-in games, if they wanted to increase the amount of attention for them, I think that only the play-in game, it should be the eight last teams to get at-large bids. In other words, if you win your conference and you get an automatic bid, I think you shouldn't be eligible to be involved in the play-in games. They got another couple of 16 seeds playing later tonight. What do you think about my hypothesis out there? Or my ideal redesign of the play-in games, such that only the top eight, the bottom eight, you know, of the at-larges would play for the final four spots that advance.
I want to say we've talked about this on the show before, and we both agree 1,000,000% on this. I think if you get an automatic bid,
there are several things
yes.
that I'll come back again and get on my soapbox for every year, because my opinion's not going to change on it.
Yeah.
But I don't ever hear anybody else making this suggestion, certainly not on a national platform like me. Why would you force the 16 seeds that nobody really knows, who have automatically won their region in their conference, why would you force them to have to play to advance to play against a one seed when they're probably going to get their brains beat in, right? I mean, it's not like it's not like they're playing like every other team that advances as a 11 seed. Feels like, hey, we match up with a 6 seed decently, like we can go win a game, and it happens all the time. A 16 seed play-in going and then beating a 1 seed is very unlikely to ever happen. So why not just go ahead and make the play-in teams compete?
No, I agree. And I think they should all be these, for the most part, they should be the major conference teams that are mediocre, that have 19 wins, or they have 20 wins, and it should be 11 versus 11 and 12 versus 12 and things like that. If you automatically qualify and you're one of these smaller schools from one of these mid-major conferences or even the not even mid-major conferences, you should be rewarded because this tournament is supposed to give everybody a chance. I don't know that it gives a chance for a 16 seed that qualified legitimately and did not have to be selected amongst a bunch of mediocrity. That team qualified. That team should be in what I believe is the actual tournament, and that's the thing that starts tomorrow, not the thing that started yesterday.
Yeah, look, I just feel like if you shouldn't, if you're a 16 seed, the odds of you being able to win a game in the tournament, notwithstanding what happened last year with Maryland Baltimore County, historically have been incredibly improbable. You shouldn't have to go to Dayton, Ohio, and never get the fun of playing in the actual NCAA tournament. That, to me, should be something that everything's about. And people say, well, what do you do? Because then you'd have more 16 seeds. Well, you only have four 16 seeds, so you'd have these guys would be 15 seeds, right? And you would just make the final play-in team all the guys that barely got into the tournament from the big conferences usually. Now, sometimes it might be a Belmont, a team that narrowly misses and loses to another talented team. And again, I give the selection committee credit for giving Belmont an opportunity to go out and prove themselves here. But I'd just rather watch all of those games, all eight teams. And I think it would also increase the amount of attention because those schools typically would have bigger fan bases.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Like, it's hard to say no offense in this case because it's definitely offensive to these people. But Fairleigh Dickinson, Prairie View A&M, North Carolina Central, North Dakota State, I didn't go to any of those four schools, so I have no interest in watching them play against one another. I don't mind watching North Dakota State play against Duke in the first round or whatever like that, but the fact that they have to qualify against one another in games that no one cares about and no one knows, this tournament at the end of the day is a gigantic business that raises a ton of money with a ton of different sponsors for all these television networks. And regardless of how you might feel about it, more people would be interested in watching, I don't know, for example, Oregon, a 12 seed, but they qualified, so they weren't an at-large this year. But a team like an Oregon, like a, I'm looking at some other ones, I mean, even the ones that were on the bubble didn't get in. I'd rather see an Alabama NC State kind of matchup in the first four with North Carolina Central and North Dakota State already qualifying because they won their way into this tournament and didn't have to be selected.
Yeah, look, I mean, and a lot of the 11 seeds end up sliding in as automatic qualifiers, and that's fine. But, for instance, instead of seeing Cincinnati play Iowa, maybe Iowa would have to try their luck again in a play-in.
Florida,
game, right?
Maybe. Seton Hall, some of those
Ohio
teams.
State.
Yeah, Ohio State.
Ohio State would do, now maybe a little bit unfair, they get to play in Dayton and sell that place out. But I think Ohio State getting to play, there'd be a lot more interest in watching them, certainly, than there would maybe some of these other smaller schools. And so I just think it would be a cool way to try to create a little bit more interest in these games overall.
No, it absolutely would. I mean, there's not really an interest level if you don't have a dog in the fight with one of these 16 seeds. And most people don't, quite frankly. I don't know if you ask me, and you said, look, I'll give you $1 million if you can name all four of the mascots of North Carolina Central, North Dakota State, Fairleigh Dickinson, and Prairie View A&M, you would watch me cry if you had a camera on me because I'd realize I'm about to lose $1 million because I couldn't name two of them, much less
like
four of them.
Here are the later of the play-ins, right? Like these teams would be playing play-in games. Somebody like Florida, we mentioned Ohio State, maybe a Minnesota. Like all of those games, Seton Hall, an Iowa, an Oklahoma, all of those teams would be Baylor in the mix potentially to be the play-in games. And again, they wouldn't be able to all be there, but you just take the final eight that get at-large bids that didn't win their conferences, and I think we would spend a lot more time focused on those games, and I think it would create a lot more interest.
I do too. I absolutely do. We're going to talk to John Campbell, our good friend out at Odd Shark. Coming up next, obviously gambling is just, well, it's huge always, especially on this program, but it's definitely huge this week with the start of the NCAA tournament, so stick around for that.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Welcome back, Geico, Outkick Studios. And I know that you are excited for the launch of the NCAA tournament, even if you are a Canadian, as you are, John Campbell. What jumps out to you about Thursday and Friday slate? The NCAA tournament officially starts off tomorrow. I know we had the play-in games start last night. I know we got play-in games tonight, but I'm going to focus, like most people are, on the bracket itself. What jumps out at you off the top from an oddsmaker perspective?
Yeah, well, one of the things that jumps out to me is these spreads seem smaller across the board. The average spread seems smaller to me now than compared to years past, especially the biggest spreads. They're not quite as big. We used to see games in the 30s or high 30s, and we're not seeing that. We're seeing a lot of smaller spreads. It makes it tough to bet, and that's because there's a lot of parity now.
So when you see these parity, and I think you came on with us last week or the week before, and you said from your perspective, Duke at effectively 2-1 is the most overhyped team in terms of future national title odds that you have ever seen. Do you stick to that after what you saw take place in the ACC tournament and how good Zion looked?
Yeah, I do, and UNC gave them a good run and could have won that game. They're 2-1 against them. They look great. I just don't think they should be 2-1. I think it should be more like 6-7, 8-1, something like that. And I just think with the popularity of Duke, that's the biggest reason here, and the popularity of Zion. Duke now has a pretty good region, though, so I think it's easily the weakest region. That changes things a little bit. I would knock them down a little bit from there. But at 2-1, I just don't see them that much better than everybody else.
All right, so what value do you see out there that you like then? You don't like Duke at 2-1, even in their region. If you were playing national title odds right now as we get ready, we're on the eve of the official start of the NCAA tournament. I never count the play-in games as the official start. What value do you see out there?
Well, I think North Carolina is going to win. So I like North Carolina at 7-1. They were 25-1 earlier on this year. I took a couple long shots. I like some of them further down the board. I took Buffalo at 80-1. I think this team's legit. It's a senior laden team. They can all score. They've got some talent. That's one I like. Villanova comes through and grits out a win in the Big East tournament here. They're 50-1. Never bet against Jay Wright. I think he's worth a go at 50-1 there as well. So those are two a little further down the board. But there are a bunch here that look okay to me. Tennessee even is 16-1 as a two seed. That seems like pretty good value to me as well.
What individual matchups do you like on Thursday and Friday? For people out there filling out their brackets or getting in their gambling tips, which ones to you stand out on the Thursday slate? Let's start there. Are there any that in your mind stand out to you right now and you think, man, I absolutely love the play here? And obviously those games start off with Minnesota-Louisville. That's the earliest kickoff, earliest tip-off, 12:15 Eastern tomorrow. And then running throughout the day. What kind of is jumping out to you?
Yeah, I wrote a few down for Thursday, Friday, so I'm not sure which is which, but these are the first 2 days, and there are a few here that I do like. And one of them is Auburn -6 against New Mexico State. They're coming off a championship run in the SEC, and Jared Harper might be the fastest guard in the country, and they hit a lot of threes. So I don't think 6 points is nearly enough there. I love that one, Auburn -6 early on. LSU -7 is another one against Yale. I know Will Wade, and I think this line here is lower than it should be just for the controversy that's been going on with LSU here. But only 7-point favorites against Yale, I just don't think that's enough either. So that's another one. Looking at the underdogs, I took Vermont +10 against Florida State. And ACC faves don't do well historically in the tournament, so I looked to bet against them here. And with Vermont getting 10 points, I think they can cover this one. They have some talent, and they beat UMBC in the America East Final here to get here. And Florida State, if they get a lead, they've got a deep bench, so I can see a kind of a backdoor cover happening in that one. Another one I like, Seton Hall +3 against Wofford. They have just become way too trendy of a 7 seed for me, and Seton Hall and the Big East, just such a gritty conference.
Big upset. Any big upset? People love to do this to brag in their brackets. What big upset to you stands out in the NCAA tournament?
Well, everybody looks at the 12-5, and with good reason here. And I like Murray State. It's not that big, but I like Murray State over Marquette here as a 4.5-point favorite early on in that one. I just think I think they're the better team. I think the spread is wrong. So I like that one there. In terms of big upsets, there were none that really stood out. I'll say Vermont. Like I think they could surprise there and win that one straight up. We saw UMBC do it last year. But one thing to know, in the first round, when you're looking at the big upsets, 85% of teams favored by 5 or more win their games in the first round. The upsets typically happen when those lower spreads by like a lot more. 53% of teams favored by less than 5 win their games. So, it is rare when we see that. And when you're filling out your bracket, just remember that there aren't a ton of upsets. It's the most exciting thing to talk about, but we typically don't see a lot of them.
It is a good point. For other tips for filling out your brackets in general, what would you tell people, as many people here, it's Wednesday morning and the tip-off is tomorrow, or getting in their brackets, or they're going to be filling them out at work and getting them in before they roll into work today?
Yeah, well, what I would say now is look for offense before defense. And I used to look at defense early on when I used to handicap college basketball, and now offense has just become so much more important. So when you're looking at teams, offense is way more important than it used to be than defense. So I'd say that. Also, don't get too caught up in the early round upsets. If the guys who pick the four final four winners are often the guys who win their pools. So try and pick the final four and then work out from there. That's one way to do it. And number one seeds go to the final four 41% of the time. So if you focus on your final four and you pick those, chances are you're going to be in great shape.
That is good advice indeed. We're talking to John Campbell at Johnny Oddshark on Twitter. While I've got you, the Golden State Warriors, are you of the belief that this is everything surrounding their team right now doesn't really matter, that basically they are going to still win the NBA title, or are you starting to think there's value elsewhere?
I'm starting to think there's value elsewhere, and it's not really so much of the, because of the controversy. I just think it's the exhaustion of going for these titles. What, five runs now they've had, and any team, any sport, when you've had that many runs in a row, and you've gone that deep in the playoffs, and you have that many stars, it just gets tougher and tougher to win. And we've heard Steve Kerr talk about this, that his biggest challenge is motivation and trying to manage his lineup there. So I think they can overcome it better than any other team, but I just think maybe all these runs have finally started to catch up with them, and I'm starting to look at other teams too.
So who would you get? Like, on Lock It In recently, I said I thought there was value on the Rockets, and I took the Rockets to potentially win the NBA title because we saw what the Rockets did last year. If Chris Paul can be healthy, I know they're the 3 seed right now, and they'd have to go out and they'd have to win, but they were arguably going to do it absent the Chris Paul injury happening. Do you kind of feel the same way as me, or how would you assess the landscape right now? Is the value actually on?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say the Rockets too. Maybe the Thunder, but the Rockets, I think they're the team that could do it. In the East, a lot of people want the Raptors. Up here in Canada, we want the Raptors. I just don't see it. In the clutch moments, they're just not getting it done. So I agree with you. I like the Rockets there too.
Outstanding stuff as always, John Campbell at Johnny Oddshark on Twitter. Anything else in the gambling universe that we should know as you ride off into the sunset here, or ride off into the sunrise this morning, I guess more accurately. Thanks for joining us early as always.
Yeah, thanks very much, Clay. I'm all in on March Madness here, so I haven't even looked at other sports this week, but it's going to be fun as always.
Good stuff. That is John Campbell at Johnny Oddshark. You can follow him on Twitter. When we return, Jason Martin and I will break down this potential blockbuster contract from Mike Trout. What could it signal going forward in the world of pro sports? This would be a blockbuster. We'll discuss Mike Trout. Will he get this new deal done with the Angels? All that and more. Outkick the Coverage on Fox Sports Radio.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Welcome back to the Geico Outkick Studios. Thanks to John Campbell for joining us. All right, Clay, speaking of Discover cards, this guy might need a fleet of them. Mike Trout, $430 million, 12 years to stay with the Angels, an average of nearly 36 a year. That tops Zach Greinke, who was making 34.4 with the Arizona Diamondbacks. Obviously, the overall money is 30% larger than what Bryce Harper just signed with the Philadelphia Phillies back on March the 2nd. It's also bigger than Canelo Alvarez and his deal by more than $65 million as well. So this is something else. A 27-year-old, $430 million. What was your initial reaction when you saw this?
You know, maybe it's wrong of me, and certainly there are many things that I'm wrong about in life, but I kind of just felt sad that he's going to spend his entire career with the Angels. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like this has been such a big debate and discussion. What does Mike Trout owe the sport of Major League Baseball in terms of being able to basically bring to bear his talent to the largest possible audience? And this is something that Rob Manfred, the Major League Baseball commissioner, had to apologize for. But I feel like the Angels are one of the least relevant in terms of people caring about them franchises in all of pro sports, not even just in baseball, right? And I understand there are Angel fans who are listening to us right now, and they're like, what are you talking about? It's great that he wants to stay committed to a team that doesn't have to be the Dodgers or the Yankees or the Red Sox or, you know, the Phillies or one of these teams. And it's funny, I'm looking out over, the strip right now where Bryce Harper is from, as we're doing the show live, late night, all lit up here in Vegas, early morning on the East Coast, late night on the West Coast. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, like, we knew that Mike Trout was going to sign a contract and eventually that was going to blow Bryce Harper's out of the water. But assuming this thing all gets done and assuming it all, you know, like, takes place in the way that we anticipate it's going to, I just wonder how many people out there are going to recognize how good Mike Trout is during the length of this contract, and how many people are just going to continue to feel kind of the way they do already, which is that Mike Trout plays on the West Coast. It's hard for people who live on the East Coast to keep up already with West Coast teams. And he's on what has been so far a relatively irrelevant West Coast team, which makes it even more difficult.
Yeah, and if you look at it from a statistical standpoint for Mike Trout, I remember we had John Morosi on and we've talked about Mike Trout many times because the question's always the same. I mean, Mike Trout is the most unrecognizable greatest of all time we've ever seen. Like, from a statistical standpoint, looking across the board at everything he does, he may go down as the greatest baseball player of all time. He's played in 3 playoff games. He's never won one. He's only been to the playoffs one time, one season, with the Angels. The Angels are able to pay him this because they just got a $3 billion local TV contract, and people do come out to that yard to see him play. He sells tickets. This makes absolute sense for them. I just look at this and I'm like, all right, you're in L.A. First off, that hurts me and it hurts a lot of sports fans because we're not going to get to see you very often because you're playing on the West Coast. That's been the problem for the NBA with LeBron James going to Los Angeles and being the second part of a doubleheader instead of the leadoff, and then you stick around for like Warriors Rockets or whatever in the second game. So it's changed that as well. So we don't even get to watch him. And of course, he just wants to go play baseball. He doesn't want to be a celebrity. And Rob Manfred came out last year and talked about how he had a responsibility to the game. He's just not a public face. Sometimes you just don't get lucky enough to get Magic Johnson or Michael Jordan or somebody like that. He is a transcendent talent who also happens to be pretty introverted. And that's unfortunate for a sport that right now needs as many extroverts as they can because they can't even convince Kyler Murray to come try to play baseball.
Well, and baseball's got this problem in general. Like, baseball locally dominates the NBA. But the NBA dominates much more the discussion because the superstars in the NBA are more national stories than the superstars are in Major League Baseball. And it's an interesting question why that is. A big part of it, I think, is that that baseball is harder to market than the NBA. And the reason why that occurs is if, you know, LeBron, let's take LeBron off the table here, and let's presume that the best player in the NBA is going to play, right? Let's say that Kevin Durant's going to play in a game. It's unlikely that Kevin Durant's going to go out in a game and go 1-for-15 from the floor, score 2 points, put up 1 rebound, and have no assist, right? That would be an improbably bad game for Kevin Durant to have. And it would be an improbably bad game for LeBron James to have. But Mike Trout can go out and bat and go 0-for-4, and he can have an error in the field, and he cannot make a great defensive play, and you wouldn't know that you just watched the best player in baseball perform because baseball is a humbling sport. And so I feel like as a fan in this day and age, if you put on a Kevin Durant game, maybe not even the regular season, because who knows if the Warriors are going to show up, but you're not going to get a total fall-on-the-face game, right? And even LeBron this year with the disaster that is the Lakers, LeBron's played really well at times. Statistically, his numbers have not been bad. And so I think that goes to why it's so hard to sell. The other thing you hit on is we've got a huge audience in L.A. I know they are the L.A. Angels. They ain't L.A.
No.
Right? I mean, they are playing down in Orange County, which has a different vibe, which feels remarkably different than if he played in Chavez Ravine for the Dodgers. We're the Dodgers affiliate here on 5 a.m. 570 LA Sports.
Hey, you got it right.
I got it right. Petros told me the other day I got it too, that a lot of people are listening to us on right now. If Mike Trout were on the Dodgers, yes, he would still play on the West Coast, and yes, it would still be difficult for people to keep track of him all the time on the East Coast. But I feel like the Dodger brand is so much more powerful and prevalent than the Angel brand that it would ultimately make a huge difference in terms of his impressions.
Yeah, it would. I mean, that town's what? It's Lakers, then it's Dodgers, then it's probably USC. I might go USC third, or at least at times you would look at USC. The Rams are starting to build something. The Angels are the Angels and nobody cares. I still think more people may be Raiders fans than they are Rams fans in Los Angeles. So I think you're dead right about that. He's playing for a franchise that is basically obscure. As we go to break and we come back, we will talk a little bit more, certainly NCAA tournament basketball. Rachel Bonetta will join the program in the third hour as well. The Angels better. Look, if you've got $3 billion in local TV money
in a non-salary cap sport, you can throw 430 to Mike Trout. Build around him. Make Mike Trout somebody we have to watch because the Angels are playing deep into September and into October. Rachel Bonetta, we think. Next, Outkick the Coverage, Fox Sports Radio.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
Welcome back. Geico Outkick Studios. We're brought to you by TrueCar. When it comes to selling or trading in your car, you need to make good choices. And with TrueCar, you've got a star on your roster. So when you're ready to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar. True cash offer not available in all areas. We are in Las Vegas this morning, as I have said many different times. And I appreciate everybody listening across this country as we roll into hour three. And I've managed to get up one of the co-hosts of my show. In fact, the person who talks the most on the show. Her name is Rachel Bonetta. You can follow her on Twitter, at Rachel Bonetta. She was willing to get up at the crack of dawn this morning.
This is inhumane. It's too early. I got a show to host today.
How much do you hate me?
Listen, Okay. I don't hate you. I just, there's a disdain, especially this early in the morning when I am doing your show. And I like to get back at you, and that will happen today.
How much does it pain you that I'm the king this week and that I'm trying to design a ridiculous, ostentatious, everyone has to pay attention to the fact that I'm the king event going on in Las Vegas this week?
I don't know what I did to deserve this cruel punishment from the gambling gods, but you know what? I will say, and I don't admit this very often, I do enjoy when you are king because you're such a
blockbuster
brat,
revelation.
You're such a brat that it makes good television. It's another level. We have fun doing the show anyways, but I know that everyone's always extra annoyed when you have the crown on your head. So it does make it a little bit more fun.
All right, so for people out there who haven't watched, we are going to be live Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at the MGM Grand Sportsbook.
Oh, yeah.
Our show goes live at 1:30 Pacific. That's 4:30 Eastern. So you can watch it on television all the time on FS1, mm-hmm. and I hope people are doing it. But if you are going to be in Vegas, you're able to come by and watch us do the show live. Full confession, we have never done a show all at the same table together, all live.
No, I don't.
How nervous are you about this entire process, to be honest?
You know what? I'm actually excited because I was more so nervous about the setup that we have now. Like, you got you in Nashville, Todd in Vegas, Sal and I in L.A. I was super nervous that it wasn't going to work out. We didn't even know each other when the show started. None of us did, except for you and Furman, really. So I think that this is like my dream scenario, all of us together at the same table. I think it's probably going to be the best three shows that we've done so far. Knock on wood.
Very furiously here. So Wednesday, the games won't be going on.
No.
And then Thursday and Friday, we'll be in a sports book while games are going on. It's going to be wild.
Yeah, it's going to be so crazy. And I think that that's only going to add to the atmosphere of it. Like, I think that even if there was nobody in the room, just the four of us all together would be super fun. But then add to that fact, there's going to be hundreds of people behind us cheering for these games that are happening live. We're also going to have an audience, which we've never had before. I'm hoping that they all dislike you and they'll join me and Sal and Todd in our heckling, because that will be fun. But it's going to be an amazing atmosphere. I think it's going to be a really fun show to watch.
Would you have ever, so you grew up in Canada. We make fun of that on the show quite a bit because obviously you have a weird accent. And we're talking to Rachel Bonetta. You can go follow her on Twitter. You can thank her for getting up early and hanging out with us here at Rachel Bonetta on Twitter. So when you, were growing up, if you had known that one day you were going to be hosting a sports gambling television show, like when you were 21 or 22, if I had told you that, because when you're like 15 or 16, nobody has any idea what's going on in the world. But even at 21 or 22, your reaction would have been what?
How is it legal? I think I would have genuinely been surprised, because when I was 21, I was dropping out of college. I was going to go back to school for theater because I didn't like broadcast journalism. I was just like, this isn't for me. And then maybe when I was probably that same year, I got a job with Toronto FC. So sports gambling was just barely coming into the picture. Sports gambling was like not even something that I was thinking about. So I would have been so surprised. But this has been honestly the ride of a lifetime. I say it all the time. This show is so much fun to do. I just come in to work and laugh for an hour every single day. I can't, you know, we all bicker and stuff on the show, but we genuinely get along in real life. And I'm having a blast. This is like the craziest thing that's ever happened in my life, getting this show, and it's been so much fun.
So one of the things I always admire is people who are naturally comfortable on television. Mm-hmm. And because people who watch television think that it's a natural thing to be comfortable in your own skin and be comfortable on television, mm-hmm. and it's not, right? For you, were you always comfortable on television? Because you're really smooth on television, right? And some people are, and like it's amazing because you hear so many people who even maybe in the media space and they like write about television and then you put them on television and they look like a deer in the headlights and you're like, oh my God, so this isn't as easy as it looks on television. Yeah. I feel like in most things, if you're good at it, it looks easy. Mm-hmm. But when you actually do it, you're like, oh, there's complications to this. What's the secret on TV? Or have you just always kind of been, I'm curious, because I don't have any secret.
I don't know, because most people don't know this. I'm like a pretty solid introvert in real life. And then as soon as that red light turns on, it's like I'm a full-blown extrovert and I'm a crazy person.
Yes.
But I really don't know. It's like a flip switches. And I get super nervous. Like, I have stage fright. I have anxiety. Before every single show. Like, there's never been a day when I've gone on television to do an hour of live television. Like, sometimes I have to pinch myself. I'm like, how am I doing this? How am I alive and still standing and I'm on live TV? It's crazy to me, but I think that you just get into a rhythm. The first like 30 seconds is scary. And then as soon as that first laugh happens, which is what I always try and put at the top of our show, in the script, as soon as you get that out, then it's just like, okay, we're smooth sailing. So I don't know if there's a formula. You either have it or you don't, I suppose. I'm really lucky that I guess I have it. But there's nothing that someone's taught me or anything like that. Like, when I was in when I was going to school for broadcast journalism, there was like a handful of people that were comfortable, and the rest of the people are just like, okay, this is probably never going to happen for you. And I'm maybe one of two people that I went to school with that are still working in television. Like, it's not an easy job at all.
Do you like, and you have a lot of talents and you do a lot of different things in a very cool way, and you're obviously doing the show out in L.A., and mm-hmm. you're doing, what's funny is interesting, and also, like, you're doing all sorts of auditions, and you're doing all sorts of mm-hmm. different movie roles, like you mm-hmm. left and went. Do you like doing live TV better, or do you like doing a scripted, you know, a performance or something like that? Because, I mean,
there's so much adrenaline that comes with live television. And once it's out of your mouth, it's done. You can't go back and do it. I think I used to hate live TV because it scared the crap out of me. But now that I'm doing it every single day, you kind of get used to it, although it's still terrifying. But the thing about going and doing movie roles or auditioning or even like taping stuff for this show, it's like, you have to get this perfect. It has to be perfect. What I love about live television is it's not perfect. And it's kind of taken me out of my head because I am absolutely a perfectionist and I want everything to be great. But at the end of the day, it's like no one's perfect and that it's not even human. I would say live television, although I totally enjoy acting. And
you guys pulled a prank on me at the Super Bowl.
Yep.
And at the Super Bowl, you guys, you and Sal, hired an actor.
Talk about waking up early. That was like a 3 a.m.
Yes.
wake-up call.
Yes, that was insanely early. You and Sal hired an actor mm-hmm. and through Fox to pretend to have a heart attack live on the radio with me. So for people out there who were listening and remember that at Radio Row or have seen that, that was you and Sal who did it, and you came on the show immediately after to talk about it.
Yeah.
And so when that happened, like, and you set me up like that, tell people how that story came to be. Like, how did you have the idea of, let's have somebody have a fake heart attack?
So we were in our boss's office upstairs, and we do a lot of sketches and stuff like that. If you guys are fans of the show, then you know that we tape a lot of stuff, and we roll it into the show. And we were thinking about things that we could do for Vegas, because we were planning, like, we were thinking about things to do for Vegas for these shows, but it was around the time of the Super Bowl. You were definitely going, we weren't. So we were like, what can we do around the Super Bowl to kind of like gain hype for our show still? It hit me like a bolt of lightning. And I was just like, oh my God, I have a crazy idea. I don't think that we'll be able to do it, but I'm just going to put it out there. And I was just like, I think that we should prank Clay. And Sal looked at me at that exact same time. He was like, I was just about to say that. Like, it hit us at the exact same time. And then he, of course, came up with all of the details, somebody going and having a heart attack on your show because he's a, an evil man.
Yes.
But it all kind of came together, and it's just like lightning hit that room, and all of us were like, oh my gosh, we're all on the same page. And then we had some auditions. We had to Skype with older men and ask them to have a
heart attack for you to see whether or not you could, they could do the work.
This is sounding so awful now that I'm saying it back. But they have, and we're like, okay, that was believable. That wasn't. He looked like he was dead. And then we found our guy, and he did a great job. And we woke up so early, and we came into the studio, and we were watching you walk around. Like, we could hear everything.
Oh, this is also ridiculous. One of the things you learn is when you're mic'd up, you get comfortable, but I didn't think about the fact that there was a ton of people listening to me on the mic, right? Yeah. And I'm saying that differently than right now we're talking on a mic and it's radio, and I understand that it's going out to all the 300 stations right. And everybody else. Like, that's literally the job. But when we go to a commercial break, like, you sit back and you don't think about you're talking to everybody, right? Mm-hmm. And so you guys were sitting listening to me, like, have conversations.
Somebody just asked you, how is Lock It In? What's Rachel and Sal like and Todd? And you were like, oh, they are just phenomenal.
But what if I had been like, I hate them, I have to pretend?
Well, that would have been pretty awkward. Then the heart attack would have felt a little bit better to do. But, no, it was such an insane. And then while it was happening, I'd never done a prank before. Obviously, Sal's done a million with Kimmel. So he was like right in his element, and he was like with the mic and talking in his ear and stuff like that. And I was the most nervous I think I've ever been. Like, I was about to have a panic attack. I was freaking out. And then it was pulled off seamlessly. It was amazing.
It was really well done. So you guys pranked me there. But then your lovely mother is coming to Nashville, and she slides into my DMs and she says, don't tell Rachel because she would kill me if she knew this, but I'm in Nashville and I was just curious if it was possible to meet up. And I was like, oh, yeah, that'd be fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, it'd be really funny almost immediately. I was like, first, you can come out like, and you can meet my family and the house and everything else. But I said, it would also be really funny is if you, like, just, like, during a commercial, right before a commercial break or right after one, like, you just stepped in and waved.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just, and then she was like, well, I don't necessarily want to do that. I'd be nervous about live television. I was like, okay, well, what about if we just, you know, record a quick video here? So
I'm
sitting at our counter.
Got her to
do
that.
She was so great. It was such a great video. And so, like, she was holding a cup, and we didn't even zoom in on this, that said world's greatest mom, right?
Aww.
So, and also she had an Outkick hat on, I think it was. So anyway, your reaction in the moment, because you didn't know, we made that video, and then I tossed to it live on the show, and suddenly your mom is sitting at the counter with me.
Oh my God, I had no idea, but so we throw to Clay, you interrupted me. Like, I have something to show you, and in the video, you're like, you know, we've made a lot of friends on this show, and literally, a second before she rolls in, I was like, it's my mom, and she's going to be on the show right now, and I just, you can see on my face,
yes.
A millisecond before she pops in, I'm like, oh, no. And I was at a loss for words, you know, usually I'm pretty quick on my feet, and I had no idea that you guys had planned that. And I called her right after, and I was like, you a-hole. I can't believe you did this to me on live television. But she had a blast. She thinks that you're very lovely.
She met everybody. Well, the people that were there, two of the kids were at school, but she met the young kid and everybody else. My mom and dad came over.
Yeah,
because my mom, well, they live nearby in Nashville, but my mom, like, anytime somebody comes to visit the house, she wants to come by and
that's
visit
so
them too.
Nice. Yeah,
so she loves the show. She loves you on the show. She's like, oh, I want to meet Rachel's mom too.
Oh, that's great.
So that was pretty fantastic. All right, so we are going to be busy for Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. But for people out there, again, who may want to come see the show, what would you tell them? And for people who haven't watched the show, what would you tell them why they should?
Oh, well, I mean, you could win some money, not if they're listening to you.
If you listen to other people's picks, you can win some money.
Style, you could probably win some money. Or if you fade Clay, you could probably win some money. Honestly, I really don't think that you need to be a fan of sports gambling to enjoy our show.
Yeah.
It's like, if you're a fan of sports, it's kind of like hanging out in a room right before a game and you're just breaking down the game with your buddies. And we laugh. We all get along really well. And I think that totally shows and adds to our program. But I think it's just a fun time. You, as the host of the show, I just sit back and I laugh for an hour. So I can't see how that wouldn't be entertaining to watch.
And it will be hopefully entertaining because we have no idea how this is going to turn out. Mm-hmm. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, live from the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. Me, Rachel Bonetta, who you're listening to right now. You can mm-hmm. find her on Twitter at Rachel Bonetta, Cousin Sal, and of course, we've got a Todd Furman.
Name?
No, I was. I don't ever like on the radio when I have to name like four things in a row. Because that's a lot of things to keep in your head while you're also mm-hmm. potentially going to toss it to break and everything else. But this has been fantastic. I appreciate you getting up early with us. We're going to have an awesome time again Wednesday, the first show. And then if you're going to be in Vegas for the Thursday mm-hmm. and Friday, while the games are going on, we will be going live at the MGM Grand.
Yeah, and I think that if you've never seen the show before, it's going to be fun to watch. But if you are a fan of the show, there's a bunch of different things that we're doing. Like, we're maybe breaking some records.
Also, you don't have a teleprompter, so it could really go off the rails.
It could really be bad, but I think it's going to be really fun to watch.
It should be pretty outstanding. I am Clay Travis. She is Rachel Bonetta. This is Outkick the Coverage. Let me bring in Eddie Garcia, find out what's shaking in the world of sports. And actually, when Eddie comes back, I want you to say hi to Danny G, who is – but let's do that beforehand. Danny G is a big fan of yours. But he also then, I got to be honest, when Alex Curry.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Yeah, when Alex Curry like hosted, he was like, hey, what's Alex's story too?
Clay, don't throw me under the bus, but it is Britt 1, Alex Curry 2, and then you, Bonetta.
I don't know.
Danny
like,
G, like, where's your alliances? I actually do really like Alex Curry, so I don't blame him.
Yeah, she's pretty fantastic too. But, I mean, Danny G selling out right there. We will continue to roll here. NCAA Tournament Breakdown, final segment. I am Clay Travis. This is Outkick the Coverage on Fox Sports Radio.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Well, she woke up. Rachel Bonetta, thanks to her. You'll see her on Lock It In. I can't wait to see what that set actually looks like on TV. Welcome back to the Geico Outkick Studios. You don't know what this set looks like either. You can picture it. It's kind of average, really. Geico's not, though. Clay Travis. In Las Vegas, Duke, Gonzaga, Virginia, North Carolina. There's your four number one seeds. Which one goes down first?
It's a great question. And by the way, before I give you my answer, I want to reiterate again, I've been pumping it all week, but I really am excited to see people who are in Vegas and want to come out and see this set. You just heard Rachel Bonetta talking about it with me. But we will be live at 1:30 Pacific time later today. It's pitch black outside right now as the sun soon will be hopefully coming up over Las Vegas. It's early in the morning here. But 1:30 would be really, really cool to see a lot of people out. And we'll be there Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at the MGM Grand Sportsbook. First number one seed to lose is, you know, it's an intriguing question because I think the first game, for instance, that Duke could lose, really lose, is Virginia Tech, right? Virginia Tech beat them in Blacksburg earlier this year. Granted, that was without Zion, but Virginia Tech was without their best player as well. So I think those kind of cancel out. So I think Virginia Tech could get them in the Sweet 16. When I look at UVA, I don't really think an Ole Miss-like team could get them in the second round. I'm assuming they can get past Gardner-Webb. So I think they probably get to the Sweet 16, and then I don't really think they have that tough of a matchup there. So to me, UVA's got a pretty good bracket. Now, I do think that that Gonzaga is potentially a little bit, I'm not going to be sold on them in the same way. Yeah, man, it's a tough call because you hate to sound like an idiot by going and saying, hey, one of these teams is going to lose in the second round or, God forbid, in the first round. But I think I would probably go with the Zags as the team that's the most likely to lose early. And I understand people out there don't necessarily buy into to my criticism of Gonzaga. But I think Syracuse is actually pretty good.
They are, and they play that zone. And when you play against that zone, some teams just absolutely lose their minds trying to deal with that. That's the one thing you don't want to see in this tournament, and Gonzaga could be staring at that in their second game.
Exactly, and we know Syracuse was good enough to go on the road and beat Duke in Cameron Indoor. They played Duke pretty competitively up in Syracuse. They played Virginia very competitively at least once. They weren't even that badly beaten by Duke in the ACC tournament. They've got a great coach in Jim Boeheim. So I think they have the ability to go out and beat the Zags in the second round. I think that's a tough draw for Gonzaga. So I would probably go with the team that I think is going to lose first being the Zags.
What college basketball has become, and basketball as a whole has become, is a chucking contest. It's a bunch of George Costanzas out there, and you can have an inferior talented team that shoots 43% from three and shows up, and Duke goes as Kentucky did in that loss. I think they were like 25% or something from three and didn't even take that many in the game, and they got beat. And that's all it takes. Like, Zion can go out there and get 35, and they could still get beat. That's the thing. Now, let me tell you one matchup that's intriguing. I'm not saying they're going to win, but I'm praying that UCF gets by VCU so that we get Duke and UCF so I can see Zion Williamson against Taco Fall, because Taco Fall is 7'6", 310 pounds, and I just want to see Zion Williamson versus Taco Fall for 40 minutes or for 20 or for as long as Taco Fall could be out there. 7'6", Clay against Zion Williamson, just for the sheer entertainment value. Please give me that in the second round.
Well, I think we might get like a Frederick Weiss. Wasn't that the guy that Vince Carter took over, who was on the French national team back in the day?
Yeah, that was Frederick Weiss, yes. He has never been seen or heard from again.
Yeah, but that could be that moment for Zion to kind of have that. It's like when Indiana Jones fought the big guy in the Indiana Jones the Temple of Doom thing, right?
Yeah.
Just to get that that moment, that battle between those two. I think that Duke, you know, lack of 3-point shooting thing, I think there's some truth to that down the stretch where it could really come into play. And it's tough for anybody out there to win six games in a row. It's very tough to win six games in a row against high quality competition. And it's also tough to be consistent in your ability to score from outside. And sometimes, you know, live by the three, die by the three is certainly a cliche, but I think it's an appropriate one. And if you're constantly dying by it, then you would think at some point Duke is going to need to make a lot more shots than they have before. And maybe Zion gets in foul trouble. Maybe something goes on there where you can't rely on his inside game, or God forbid, another shoe blows out. Can you imagine if that happened again in the Final Four, the NCAA tournament, if Zion suddenly had another shoe? Nike, I don't know how Nike recovers from that. But it would be amazing to see.
I mean, the big upset that I'm looking, if I'm just looking at numbers, I think the ones and twos are going to get through the first round. If I had to pick one today, I would say Yale has a real shot against LSU. Yale's a good team, and LSU has a whole lot on their minds. They're not going to have their coach out there. There's just a lot swirling around that program, and for them to show up and maybe not show up that day would not shock me. They have a ton of talent. They should win the game. I don't know if they're actually going to win the game. So lock it in is this afternoon. We're finally going to get to see that set, Clay. We got about 20 seconds left. I can't wait to see what this thing looks like.
Just trust me, it looks awesome. I can't wait. I hope a bunch of OutKick fans come out and see it, and I look forward to seeing everybody else.
So we will preview this thing top to bottom for you tomorrow, and we will see you then. Play-in games tonight, do they count? I mean, I guess they do. We'll watch them at least. OutKick the coverage, Fox Sports Radio.